You're listening to Knowledge at Wharton on Business Radio, Sirius XM 111. Here again is Dan Loney.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to hour number two here on Knowledge at Wharton on Sirius XM 111, Business Radio powered by the Wharton School. Thanks for spending part of your day with us. It is the 3rd of October. Coming to you from sunny, yet maybe a little chilly Philadelphia here today as fall has definitely kicked in full speed. Coming up here in hour number two, there are many people looking to help the victims of the natural disasters we have seen over the last 2 months. Right now, the focus partly is on Puerto Rico. So what do they need and what can you do to help in the best efforts? And then in our final 30, how was it that America became the biggest economy in the world? A new book looks at the 400-year path to that end result. And we'll talk with the author of the book, Americana, coming up at 11:30 Eastern Time. All of that in hour number two of our show. The way for you to join in and give us your comments or your questions is either by phone at 844-WHARTON, 844-942-7866. Or if you'd like, send us a comment via Twitter, either at BizRadio111, BizRadio111, or my Twitter account, which is at DanLoney21. First, though, our number of the day, and that number of the day today is 55, as in 55%. That is the rate at which ATM fees have increased over the last decade. Probably not a total shock for those of you who have maybe hit the ATM in the last few months. That number, according to Bankrate.com, the report looked at fees at 247 banks during July and August, with the average out-of-network withdrawal costing consumers $4.69, which is about a 2.5% increase over last year alone. In fact, we have seen ATM fees increase now for 11 consecutive years. You want to know where to stay away from if you don't want to pay the high fees? Stay away from Pittsburgh, because that city has the highest out-of-network fees of any city in the United States, currently averaging $5.19 every time you hit the ATM in the Pittsburgh area. Dallas, ironically enough, is the lowest at $4.07. And this, again, is why it is so important to try and find places where they don't charge you the fees. Here in the Philadelphia area, people normally go to the Wawa, so they don't have to pay the ATM fees. 55, our number of the day, 55%, the rate of increase of ATM fees we have seen in the United States on average over the last decade. The island of Puerto Rico is still dealing with trying to get its basics back up and running after Hurricane Maria devastated that U.S. territory. Only about 5% of the island has power at this point. Roads and bridges have been destroyed, and it will take quite a while to get them back up and built. And many people around the world want to know the best ways that they can help the people there, as well as in the U.S. Virgin Islands, get back on their feet. Kate Hovde is a senior advisor in education issues at the Center for High Impact Philanthropy here at Penn School of Social Policy and Practice. She joins me in studio. Also joining us on the phone is Laura Fredericks, who's an adjunct instructor at New York University's School of Professional Studies. She's also author of The Ask for Business, for Philanthropy, and for Everyday Living, which is coming out in just a few days. She joins us on the phone. And also joining us as well is Una Oseli. Thank you very much all for joining us today. Kate, Laura, and Una, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks. Thank you. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you all.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. I think most people assume, Kate, that the immediate needs are obviously food, water, clothing, et cetera. And for many cases, they are. The funds part of it, though, is something that we're going to talk about, because it's very important in many cases to provide money to organizations so that they can figure out what the most important needs are.
That's right. One of the characteristics of disaster relief is that needs change very quickly on the ground, and giving organizations flexibility to meet the needs on the ground is really, really important. It's also important to think long term as well as shorter term.
Laura?
She's absolutely right. I think cash is king. As we say during disasters, there's a natural tendency for people to want to go immediately and help and volunteer, and sometimes these organizations and the places do not have the capacity to handle volunteers. And also, it's about sustainability. I always encourage people to think about not the initial amount to give, but do it over monthly giving, because these folks are going to need money long, long after we're talking now. I mean, if you just think about history and Hurricane Katrina,
right,
they still aren't fully recovered, and you know that was quite some time ago.
Una, the numbers of organizations that are out there are a relatively healthy number. So people do have a variety of different options as to where they can provide funds for these organizations to head into Puerto Rico or the U.S. Virgin Islands.
That's correct. The tendency, though, it's human nature, is I give, I want to see an immediate impact of someone being helped. And that's the hard thing, is to talk about donor expectation, because, you know, you see this on the news, and the news has just been inundating with graphics, and it really pulls at your heartstrings. And when people write the check or donate online, in their mind, they want to see immediate results, and this can take quite some time. And I think that they get a bit discouraged, and so there's a hesitancy to say, well, you know, maybe if I give, it's not going to be immediate. Maybe I should wait. But then they don't give. So it's an interesting cycle we have to watch.
But part of it, Una, also, is seemingly, and we've touched on this on this show in the past, is the concern of certain entities out there that are posing as legal charities that are collecting money illegally. They are not giving this money to the organizations.
Correct.
And if people have been conditioned into that, that's probably part of the reason why they believe they need to see that immediate return.
Absolutely. I think in today's context, donors have a number of options when they're vetting charities and doing research on the nonprofits they'd like to donate to. I think there are a vast number of organizations right now working on hurricane relief in Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands. I would encourage donors to do their homework. There are several websites, for example, Charity Navigator, as well as Better Business Bureau for Charities, that allows you to look and see across the spectrum what are the organizations that are on the ground and are delivering effective relief. And the good news is that there are a number of organizations that already have a presence in Puerto Rico and already have a longstanding network of relationships that will allow them to effectively meet needs, and those may evolve over time. I think that's what we've learned. So whether it's large organizations that have the capacity or smaller grassroots organizations that are doing effective work on the ground, I think donors can take the opportunity right now to actually vet those charities, look at some of their websites, as well as some of the third-party websites that provide this sort of overview, and then make their decisions. But one of the criteria that donors should also look at is that organization's track record and their presence on the ground, because organizations that already are established and can mobilize very quickly to deliver relief are probably better placed and positioned in this environment.
Well, Kate, you and SP2 did a blog post the other day about that specifically, just to kind of enlighten people on some of the organizations that are actually in this realm, especially for Puerto Rico, that people may need to think about.
We did, and I would definitely agree with my panelists' comments on doing your homework on organizations. We try, you know, we do not necessarily provide an exhaustive list. There are other right. people that provide longer lists, and there's some great resources out there. Charity Navigator, Charity Watch, Better Business Bureau being some of them. Folks that have ties to Puerto Rico. We tend to give examples of like this short and longer term. So there are organizations on the ground that have been on the ground and have both an emergency capacity and longer term work. So we mentioned Save the Children's work, which has an emergency response, but then continues to work with families in the intermediate term. We also mentioned Feeding America, which is sort of a network of food banks nationally, has a great reputation, and has an existing relationship with the Banco de Alimentos, the food bank in Puerto Rico, and given the crop destruction that went on, those are going to be intermediate to long-term needs for sure.
Well, and that's the other piece to this, Laura, as well. I mean, this is, when we talk about long-term, I think a lot of Americans maybe put it in the framework of 6 months.
Exactly, and we're going on years here.
Yeah.
What I wanted to add also is a note of caution is you're going to see a lot of GoFundMe sites come up. And we saw this, particularly I'm here in New York City with, you know, Hurricane Sandy. There were dozens that came up, and I would really caution people, if you don't know the person specifically, be very cautious, because that's something Charity Navigator cannot vet, is these GoFundMe. But yeah, long-term means long-term. I just came out of New Orleans. We are still doing some major repairs and cleanup, and that was how many years ago?
Yeah.
So this is definitely going to be long-term. And one thing about this is very unusual, is these are back-to-back-to-back disasters. We haven't even talked about Harvey or Maria or, you know, the earthquakes and the unfortunate, horrible incident in, you know, Las Vegas. People are just getting bombarded with this, and it'll be very interesting to see from our perspective is, will there be donor fatigue, and then will this giving to all of these relief efforts and disaster efforts, will it have an impact on people's usual giving of what they normally fund now that we're going into the gift-giving season? So we want to watch that very carefully. Traditionally and historically, disaster relief has not taken the place of normal giving. But this is very unusual with so many happening in a very dense two-month period. Be something to see next year as we track this.
Well, Una, that's probably a concern for a lot of organizations around the country. And again, the potential of lost funds, lost donated funds for other entities that, you know, they have on their agenda, these organizations have on their agenda over the course of the year, they could potentially be impacted by this.
That's a very important question, and one that we think about a lot on our team here. As you know, the Lilly Family School, in partnership with Giving USA Foundation, does the research and writing for Giving USA every year. And that is a question we have addressed both at the national macro level, but also looking at individual households, foundations, corporations, and so forth. And I would agree with my fellow panelists that in the past, we've actually seen donors give in addition to their regular annual gifts, and often disaster giving can be a gateway into supporting a cause. So one example is during the 2004 Asian tsunami, we saw some donors who started giving to international organizations and continued that even after the disaster, whether that was World Vision or some other international relief organization that was delivering assistance during the 2004 tsunami. So in the past, I think the organization working on the ground have been able to, in some cases, provide messaging to donors that explains how this gift can assist and can make a difference. And that is separate from annual giving. And even among donors across the income spectrum, we saw that commitment to giving above and beyond. However, in this time frame, this is an unprecedented environment given the number of disasters that we've seen in a relatively short space of time. And there may be local effects. In other words, Houston will be different from what's happening in Puerto Rico as far as the time frame required for rebuilding. I think the message for nonprofits and nonprofit leaders is to continue to make the case to donors, whether you're working in the relief landscape or in another sector, whether that's the environment or something else, but being very mindful and intentional about how your organization's mission is still quite relevant, even in this very difficult time, and continuing to engage donors and cultivate donors. I think the mistake would be to retreat and say perhaps donors are not going to give because of all these disasters. So I think there's a time to be intentional, but also focused in terms of explaining what your organization does and how that differs.
That is Una Osili from Indiana University. Also joining us, Laura Fredericks of NYU and Kate Hovde here at the University of Pennsylvania. We are talking about how people can provide for the people of Puerto Rico, charitable giving, whatever it might be. 844-WHARTON is the number to give us a call, 844-942-7866. Or if you can't get your phone, you can send us a comment via Twitter and we can bring it up on the show that way. At Biz Radio 111, BIZ Radio 111, or my Twitter account, which is at Dan Loney 21. Two things, Kate, that I saw in the post that you and SP2 did that I wanted to bring up. One, this idea of pooled funds, and tell people what that is. And secondly, the interesting thing was something that you wrote in that post is that I guess the state of Massachusetts is actually doing a fund or like a GoFundMe to be able to benefit the people of Puerto Rico?
Yeah, so pooled funds are what they sound like. They're where people give to a fund. Normally, it's administered by a nonprofit. The ex-presidents, four ex-presidents got together on the One America appeal, which is benefiting. If you give, you go to one site and you can choose a variety of organizations benefiting a variety of the communities that have been affected by the recent disasters, including the U.S. Virgin Islands, Puerto Rico, Houston, etc. And usually those funds are pooled different donors, but they're administered by a foundation or nonprofit that knows the local scene pretty well.
Right.
And those funds can be used flexibly. We were talking about flexibility earlier in the program. Can be used flexibly to meet needs as they change and can be used long term, which is really, really important. As far as the Massachusetts example, that was an interesting one. The state politicians teamed up with the Boston Foundation, which has a history of doing disaster relief. They were involved in disaster relief after the Haiti earthquake. It's the first fund that I've seen which recognizes that one of the long-term effects of the Puerto Rican and U.S. Virgin Islands disasters may be that there are folks that from the islands that, at least on a temporary basis, may need to settle on the mainland.
Right.
And this particular fund not only includes a third for recovery, a two-thirds for long-term, third for relief, two-thirds for long-term, but also includes the possibility of helping folks who settle in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And I think you may see more funds moving in that direction as some folks decide that they can't stay.
Do you see that potentially, especially and having spent time in Boston, they have a very strong Puerto Rican community in and around Boston. Philadelphia does. I mean, a lot of the major cities do. That these cities, especially the ones that have strong ties to these particular territories or countries, will look to set up these types of funds because they realize that it's a major, it's a good segment of their community to begin with.
Right, and I think those. I mean, the Puerto Rican communities in the U.S. have been instrumental in raising money and raising awareness of the situation in Puerto Rico for sure. I think they're definitely going to be helping in the rebuilding, but it is also possible that a certain percentage of the population currently in Puerto Rico may need to be temporarily, may move to the mainland temporarily.
And Laura, also the interesting thing about this story is, as has been brought up on a variety of occasions, is that, you know, when Harvey and Irma went through, we're talking about the U.S. mainland, mm-hmm. where we have, you know, such an unbelievably large infrastructure that within a few hours we were able to get stuff in there. It's
right.
a little bit different instance when you're talking about an island that's 1,200 miles away from Florida. The U.S. Virgin Islands basically in the same way, and Dominica as well is basically in the same boat. It takes a little bit more from the infrastructure perspective to try and get a lot of these things to these locations.
And Dan, I love the way you use the word infrastructure, because I predict that we are going to start seeing funds specifically for infrastructure.
Sure.
We all saw the news where there's crates and crates of food and supplies, and there's not truck drivers to drive it there.
Yeah.
Even if there were, there are not roads to get it there.
Yeah.
So when we look at this, really the disaster relief in the humanitarian way, absolutely, but let's take a look at the infrastructure. How do we do this? Right now, you know, we have people like Mark Cuban sending private planes because that's the only way we can reach these individuals. So I think that the word infrastructure is going to be very important in planning, because I come back to donor fatigue. There's going to come a point where people saying, I have no more to give, and it doesn't seem to be helping because the next disaster is coming up, and what will that do? So I think infrastructure is very, very important, especially for outlying areas or even on the coastal areas of the United States. Let's take a look at infrastructure. Are we truly prepared for this? Or what could we do now that will help those efforts going forward?
Una?
Yes, I think the point about infrastructure is an important one, and it also highlights something we started to talk about earlier, which is what do organizations need, what do families need, what do communities need, and I think an important point to underscore is that unsolicited donations, especially unsolicited in-kind assistance, whether you're sending water, blankets, food items that organizations haven't specifically asked for could actually constrain efforts, make it more difficult for organizations because they have to now figure out the logistics to move some of those supplies to the communities in need. So I think for donors, it's really important to kind of pay attention. And we talked about cash, but I think it may be worth highlighting that in-kind assistance can be helpful, but in situations where infrastructure challenges exist, it might actually be more difficult for organizations. I think that in the Puerto Rico example, what we're also learning is that communities are proving to be very resilient, and the networks of generosity that exist are really kind of rising to the surface. And as communities are being helped, I think I would basically urge a lot of the donors and the nonprofits working in those communities to kind of recognize those as how to use those networks and how to build on them. A few years ago, we have, last year actually, the school released a report on giving in Puerto Rico, and there we saw this, not just the formal giving, but the importance of informal networks, people helping friends, family, neighbors, and I think that's a strength. And as relief organizations are working in Puerto Rico to really build on that resilience and generosity.
Kate?
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. I think that's right.
The GoFundMe element, though, is kind of an interesting piece, Kate, that we've seen obviously in the last few years for a variety of different projects, but obviously it plays into the conversation here, especially when you have the NFL player J.J. Watt, who set up a GoFundMe campaign. He wanted to raise $200,000 for the relief efforts in Houston. He ended up getting, I think, $33 million, which, you know, it obviously brings an element that we didn't see 10 years ago, 15 years ago, which is a benefit to this whole process.
Oh, sure. And, you know, people who have a high profile, celebrity profile can be really, really important in augmenting efforts to raise funds. I think you do have to be a little bit careful. I mean, the GoFundMe, for example, we had Penn students band together through Puerto Rican Penn students banding together to start a GoFundMe. But the beneficiary of the GoFundMe was an established fund set up by the First Lady of Puerto Rico and with corporate support as well. So the question is, like, who's managing the fund, I think.
Right.
And, you know, as long as the fund is managed by an entity that has a track record and is trustworthy and can handle grants and find the right people to grant to, that's great.
But again, that goes back to the investigation that the people have to do when they're giving this money.
Sure.
And the question then becomes, how often do people do the due diligence and how often do they not? And, you know, it leads to some of the legal issues that we talked about earlier.
Well, Dan, you know, it's interesting. As a lawyer, I can tell you that they don't. But what they hear is the first scandal you're going to hear of where the money got diverted or didn't do, suddenly there's this blanket thing that anyone who did a GoFundMe, which I brought up earlier again, where's the money going to go? And I'm glad you brought up J.J. Watt, because right now they're under this undaunting task of who is going to be part of this new foundation, who's going to decide where it goes, when it goes. And suddenly it's going to be, okay, show us in one grid or an infographic where the $33 million go. And it's not, people don't know, that's not that easy. It's not that kind of a process. It's not something you do overnight. It's something you have to be very thoughtful. You have to track. You have to go back and show impact. Where did it go? Because the minute one thing comes out, there's this blanket thing across that almost all of them are a fraud. And that's no place you want to be right now.
Right. That's really damaging to the disaster fundraising generally.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And the funds are certainly needed.
And Una, that goes back to the conversation we were having a few minutes ago of what that can potentially do to charitable organizations in general as a whole. If you have that negativity, it's obviously good. And those are things that probably don't go away in a short period of time. They stick with organizations or stick with the kind of the sector of philanthropy, of giving, for a long period of time.
Absolutely. I often, and research I think bears this out, that trust is the glue that holds the nonprofit sector together. Donors give because they have confidence that the organization will deliver on what it says it's going to do. And I think this is a two-way relationship. Donors invest in a nonprofit, and then that nonprofit then has the responsibility to steward those funds effectively, to provide transparency and accountability. flexibility around how those gifts are used. And I think today's environment, donors just expect more from the nonprofits they support. As we think about why GoFundMe and crowdfunding sites more broadly have become more popular, I think it speaks to donors' interest in seeing results and seeing the immediate impact of their gift. And sometimes by giving directly to an individual, you can see those gifts. You get real-time information how your gifts are adding up or making a difference. I think the other point to make is how easy it is to, one, set up those accounts and also give. It's kind of the frictionless world in terms of lowering barriers to giving. However, I think, once again, donors do have to do their research and homework and can't just assume that because someone is putting up a site that that is a legitimate charity or an individual that is going to benefit. So doing their homework, whether it's a crowdfunding platform or an established nonprofit, to make sure that aligns with what that donor wants to accomplish.
Kate, do you see more organizations that ask for specific items more so than just asking for the funds, or is that even shifting a little bit?
So I think it's come up a couple of times, but it's a really important point, so I'll reiterate it. Cash rather than in-kind donations generally is the way to go in short-term disaster relief, for sure. And that message, I think, has been getting out more over the last couple of years and the last couple of disasters, which is a great thing. There are instances where, for example, during Harvey, the Texas Diaper Bank asked for diaper donations.
Sure.
And if a particular organization on the ground asks for a particular thing and you have a way of getting it there effectively, great. Otherwise, cash is really, really the best way to go.
Laura?
I agree 100%. And, you know, one thing that we haven't talked about, Dan, for the first time I've been watching this, we haven't talked about call for volunteers. Remember when we had Katrina? We were sending busloads of people down to help and clean up and on and on. You don't hear the word volunteer a lot. You hear, as Kate said, cash or specific supplies. But I think this is a very, very different time now that people are just, they either don't have the time or, like you said, it's too remote. There's nothing. They can't get there. It's too far away. It's an island. But it'd be very interesting to see the quantity of cash versus in-kind versus volunteer base, other than people like firefighters or first responders or on and on. But you don't hear that a lot, which is very, very interesting to me, because normally, human reaction is, you want to help someone, I'm going to go. But we're not talking about that for the very first time.
Well, you see that a little bit in terms of the response, but not necessarily the recovery.
Exactly.
Obviously, with Harvey, everybody talked about the Cajun Navy, that was going through Houston and trying to help save people, or at least make sure that people were okay.
Mm-hmm.
To a degree, they're talking about it right now in Las Vegas with all of the people that ended up helping, that were at that concert, that ended up helping out others that who were hurt.
Mm-hmm.
So is that change of discussion, is that just kind of the culture that we are in right now, or is it truly, well, it is in the case of Puerto Rico, it's because of the remoteness of the location?
I think it's the remoteness, but also I'm going to come back. Think about this. We've had like five back-to-back.
Sure.
If it was just one, we would be concentrating on just one. And let's say it was just Texas. We'd be talking about, okay, they still need recovery. We can send people. We can send our college students. We can whatever. But then you get hit with another one and another one and another one. And you sit as the average person and say, how can I help? And most people do want to send money or send things. But I think this is a very unprecedented time where if it were just one, I think there would be a call for people to go help in this area, and they could see results once they go. But there's been so many and so many choices. It's like you wake up every day and it's like, what is the disaster of the day?
Yeah.
Whether it's here around the world. We haven't even talked about the things happening around the world, just, that's contained, just in the United States and Puerto Rico and Mexico.
Una?
Yes, I think this is a really unprecedented environment. As we've been tracking these disasters, starting with Harvey, we shifted to start covering Irma and now Maria, and as you mentioned, Las Vegas. The interesting point, I think, that we need to also note, even though they all seem to be coming back to back, is each of these disasters is unique and has the communities that are affected will have unique recovery and rebuilding challenges. And it's It's important to stress that it's not the same thing across Puerto Rico, across what's happened in Houston and Florida. And it's important that donors, advocates, nonprofit leaders, and policymakers really look at each unique circumstance and how best to address those challenges, because it's not going to be, as we've already noted, a quick solution. And recovery takes time, especially given the infrastructure needs, especially in Puerto Rico. So I am very mindful of how different recovery looks in the Caribbean compared to the U.S., and that may be one thing to really communicate back to, whether it's the nonprofits working in those communities or all of the donors that are supporting those relief efforts.
Which is going to be my last point, Kate, because I mean, we understand obviously a lot of things, and we see it on the TV of what happened in Texas with Harvey, what happened in Florida with Irma coming through there. The first 24 to 48 hours after Maria hit Puerto Rico, we still didn't have a lot of TV coverage, or let alone communication in general, because the power was out. And that made it even more tougher for people to truly understand what the needs really were.
Right. No, I think that's right. And you know, they're still assessing what the needs are and will be for a while. And on the volunteerism, sort of the lack of a lot of talk about volunteerism with Puerto Rico, I'm not sure that that's true in some of the Puerto Rican communities, but
right.
it's been very hard to get back and forth, and it's early. It's really early as far as Maria goes. So I think you may see some conversations about that. But yes, I think absolutely it is true that these are separate disaster situations, and you have to evaluate them separately.
Great to have you all with us. Thank you, Kate. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate your time. Laura, Una, thank you very much for joining us on the phone today. Thank you again.
Thanks, Dan.
It was a pleasure. Thank you for having us.
Thank you. Kate Hovde from the University of Pennsylvania, Laurie Fredericks from NYU, and Una Osili from Indiana University. We will take a break. Our final 30 coming up in just a minute. After the break, we take a historical look at the buildup of the American economy, the amazing growth that we saw not just over the last 100 years, but over 400 years. We'll take a look at that from the book Americana. We'll be talking with the author in just a minute. Sirius XM 111 Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School.